This is 89.9 WWNO. If it's Fat Tuesday in New Orleans, everybody knows. This is the day when you can be who or whatever you please. Let your hair down and do what you wanna. Did you get up early enough to catch a Zulu coconut? Did you see Rex, the king of carnival? Did you costume on this special day? Maybe you paraded as a current politician or an historical figure from way back when. A celebration of Mardi Gras is in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. They parade with torches, flambeau carriers lighting up the night skies during carnival. Writer Ryan Fertel has been fascinated by these keepers of the light since he was a young boy. He writes about the city's complicated history with the Mardi Gras flambeau in the upcoming spring issue of Oxford American Magazine. Ryan Fertel, welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, how were you first attracted to the flaming torch and the men that bravely carried them?
I was just fascinated with the spectacle, and the spectacle of the fire and the spectacle of the labor involved in carrying these 8-foot-tall, 70-pound torches that have, I later found out, 2 gallons of kerosene perched on top. It seemed wild. It seemed fun as a kid. You know, I have memories of my grandmother filling my pockets with coins for throwing to these men. They walk and they dance for tips while lighting up the parade route procession. And there was also a painting in my grandmother's restaurant. She had a restaurant in Mid-City. And we sat at the same table whenever we went as a family. It was her table. She could see like the whole dining room. She could see the kitchen from that table. And behind her, always over her shoulder, was this kind of Mardi Gras tableau of these flambeau carriers. It was this painting by Robert Rucker, I found out later, who was a French Quarter painter. And he painted the Comus Parade. And in the background of this painting is the King of Comus, and he's kind of like in his big crown and, you know, on his float. He's floating above the crowds. But he's really much in the background. And it's usually the king that gets so much attention. The king is famous. But it's these flambeau carriers who are really the characters of this painting. They're front and center. You can see their faces. There's just real beauty in the work that they're doing and in the way the painting was kind of performed.
You had a unique carnival experience in the restaurant. I believe this is Ruth's Chris Steakhouse.
Mm-hmm.
As a lot of the crew members from the old line parades would dine there.
The painting portrayed the King of Comus, and asking my uncle and other family members and restaurant workers who ate at this restaurant, and it was often the Kings of Comus, the Kings of Rex, and their families. My grandmother invited, you know, them in as customers, and I'm sure appreciated their business, but was never a member.
Now, the flambeau has a long storied history in New Orleans. You travel back in time to the 1700s to tell the story in your essay, The Keepers of the Light. How did this tradition begin?
In the historical record, as soon as we have mentions of Mardi Gras celebrations, carnival celebrations in New Orleans, we can find instances of flambeau being mentioned. So 1730, we have one of the first documents from carnival, and it's a diary entry from a French colonialist. He masks with a group of other carnival goers, and they're walking to a party the night before Mardi Gras, and they enlist the aid of some torchbearers who he calls flambeau. And after that, you know, the word flambeau kind of pops up here and there. The word flambeau in French means just a burning torch, means a fire. We can't find flambeau in every parade, although they likely lit up all nighttime parades. We can't find mention of them. That starts to change around the 1880s, when the flambeau became something that journalists from out of town, parade goers, tourists, really took a liking to and mentioned in newspaper articles and elsewhere. And they always mentioned the flambeau, and they usually mentioned that these were black men, and they would describe them as dancing, as mirthful, as lighting the parade. The flambeau were anonymous, treated as just like walking spotlights for these nighttime parades. And that really changes with a strike they struck in 1946, so right after World War II. There was no carnival, no Mardi Gras celebrations for the 4 years of the war. And the city was really, really hungry for Mardi Gras, for parades, for all the fun and celebration that comes along with Carnival in 46. And the flambeau carriers, many of whom were veterans of the war, struck for higher wages. They wanted over $5 an hour, a few dollars more than they had made before the war. The captains of the crews said no, and so they refused to carry the torches. And many parades that year just walked in the dark.
Tell us more about this complicated history of the flambeau, the issues of race, money, and exploitation that went on during those years.
Well, I think what's most interesting about the flambeau is there's a true lineage and there's a true carrying of the torch and passing down of the torch. And it's been like that really since the 1940s, at least, when the flambeau are really documented with a special eye to who these people were and their names. And they talk a lot, often, about how important these lineages were, how important it was to do something that a father or grandfather had done. And the money is good, too. They do get tips along the parade route in addition to getting paid to carry the torch by the crew itself. And the tips can be quite good. Some flambeau carriers talk about making $400, $500, $600 a night. When I was a kid, as I mentioned before, a lot of those tips were thrown. They were coins. If you go to a parade nowadays, parades that still have flambeau carriers, it's about eight, you'll see people handing coins and dollar bills to the flambeau carriers instead of throwing those things in the air. I think that really has to do with what happened in the early 90s with Mardi Gras in the city, and that's the integration of the carnival crews and the city council amendment, really, law, not allowing any parades that didn't integrate their membership roles from parading on the streets. After the strike in the 1940s, there's another strike a few years later in the 50s, and there's another strike after that. This happens at the exact same time as advances in lighting. So we have fluorescent lighting, neon, all the lighting that these super crews have now. And the flambeau became obsolete. At the same time, you had op-eds in the local newspapers saying that the flambeau needed to go, that they didn't add much to Carnival, that they were antiquated, that they were dangerous. You are carrying kerosene and flames above your head and surrounded by crowds. And so the tradition started to be phased out by crews. That really changes around the same time in the 1990s, or comes back. There's a flambeau renaissance started by Harry Connick Jr. and his Orpheus Parade, which first hits the streets in 93. Harry Connick Jr. was very much interested in returning flambeau to the streets, so he had some artisans craft flambeau sticks that harken back to ones from the 19th century. He recruited men and families who had done this for generations and for decades. And since then, other crews have brought the flambeau kind of really back to the streets and back to the parades. And I don't think it's going to leave. I think it's really part of parades nowadays. The flambeau and these fluorescents, these LED lights, kind of now walk hand in hand throughout the street.
Tell us a story that you learned during your research as you talked with the flambeau carriers.
Yeah. You know, despite unfriendliness by kind of many facets of the Mardi Gras street experience, they have been, in their minds, underpaid, and they have struck for higher pay over the decades. They have also had many run-ins, especially in the 70s and 80s, flambeau carriers did, with the New Orleans Police Department, who at that time, up until the 90s really, were the captains of the flambeau. And so it was the police that really policed the flambeau scene. And along with that came some over-policing. And so a lot of the flambeau today talk about stories of when police would abuse them physically and verbally. Every single flambeau I talk to says they still continue the tradition because of these family lineages.
And women are joining now.
Women are joining, yeah.
Now, you're talking about a renaissance of the flambeau. Are we going to see this in a lot more parades, or is it still a small echelon of crews that use the flambeaus?
Yeah, I think we have to kind of distinguish between the authentic flambeau, so that's with the pot of kerosene atop the cross-shaped stick, and there's more modern flambeaus, which we've seen kind of really come on the scene in the past two decades. And so these flambeaus, the gas or the fuel source is carried on a backpack, and a lot of flambeau carriers, although they'll do this for the money, they look down on it and they call it not the real thing. They call it not authentic. It is safer, of course. There's also been over the years, some attempts at doing flambeau without actual fire, so some sort of LED lights or something. Those are, you know, don't really work. So I think we have a handful of parades. We have more parades now doing the flambeau than were 20 years ago, but it's still nowhere near the number that used flambeau carriers, say 50 years ago or 100 years ago, when every single night parade did.
Now, you have come full circle in your research. You joined them.
I debated for years whether it was something I should do, and Clarence Holmes, I interviewed him many times over the years. You know, I begged him for stories, I stalked him, I kind of followed him, and eventually 2 years ago, he turned to me and said, "Are you going to do this?" And I said, "No, I won't. Like, it's not the right thing for me to do. I'm just a reporter. I'm a journalist and I'm a teacher here in New Orleans. This is not for me." And he said, "You know, you really should do it." And I did. I did it 2 years ago for the Orpheus Parade. And it was a tremendously difficult and tremendously inspirational in that I was inspired to, like, understand the story more experience. It's brutal. It's 70 to 80 pounds, as we know, living in New Orleans. Rainstorms and windstorms strike at any moment, and that's what happened that night. You know, it felt like a hurricane. It was probably only 10 mile per hour winds, but my torch was spinning and the flames would keep sputtering out. But it was really interesting because there was four of us. We were the first group of flambeau, the front four, the first four, they call it. And all of our lights were sputtering out. And each time we'd kind of rally, we'd huddle together and relight each other. We did this over and over from Lee Circle to the end of the parade.
But something happened to you in that experience.
Something did happen. I discovered something in the historical record that, you know, it really has not been mentioned. But in 1887, you have the first advertised flambeau parade. And the papers describe it as this new spectacle that is going to appear on the streets of New Orleans for the first time. And as I mentioned before, there were flambeaux, of course, and they were sometimes called flambeaux, but an actual flambeau parade and something actually centered around the flambeau with a flambeau at the center happened in 1887. What's interesting about this is these were not African-American men, these carriers, but they were white Confederate veterans. And this first flambeau parade in 1887 was a rally of white solidarity and neo-Confederate post-Reconstruction in New Orleans. It was all centered around the unveiling of a new Confederate general statue. They started at that statue, and they walked down St. Charles. There's dozens of flambeaux, and the crowds came out in the thousands, the report said. They were attended by cannons and musketeers. It was a real show of kind of military force and just this extravagant spectacle. So they walked from the unveiling of a new Confederate statue to Lee Circle. Lee Circle had been renamed just a few years before. They surround Lee Circle, and they salute General Robert E. Lee. There's fireworks and the flambeaux. They set off cannons and gunfire. And if you've ever been to one of the big Mardi Gras parades, they all do still pass below the gaze of General Robert E. Lee and Lee Circle in the city. Recently, there's been a worthy cause, in my eyes, to remove that statue and other Confederate memorials from the city. And that night, while we, flambeau carrier, as part of that first four for the crew of Orpheus, as we neared Lee Circle, it started to just wind and rain tremendously. And the skies were blacked out, and the sputtering of our flames just gave off all this smoke. And as we circled around this statue, I started dancing. And I'm not much of a dancer. I'm not a dancer. And the flambeau identity demands that you dance, you perform. And Clarence Holmes, who was the supervisor of our first four, of those first four flambeau carriers, kept encouraging me to dance. He kept saying, "Dance, you gotta dance, you gotta dance." Once that rain and wind started hitting, I started to dance. And it felt like something, like I'd never felt more involved in Carnival and Mardi Gras in my life. And so I started dancing. I felt like maybe the crowds couldn't see me anymore. I felt like it was the only way to keep dry and warm. I was also tired after 2 miles of carrying. I was covered in kerosene. And as we neared Lee Circle, we danced more and more. And we seemed to be, in my mind, kicking up like so much smoke and so much carnivalesque. I remember looking up, and that statue of Lee, where all Mardi Gras parades cross, was gone. We could no longer see him. I'll always remember that. It was kind of the heart of Mardi Gras itself, which is a time for carnival. It's a time for rebirth. It's a time for some sort of renaissance. It's a time for making better, often while acting a fool, while dancing, while masked. There was something radical that happened and something like very magical.
Writer Ryan Fertel. Happy Mardi Gras.
Happy Mardi Gras.
Ryan Fertel's essay, Keepers of the Light, will be in the spring issue of Oxford American Magazine next month. You can get a sneak peek online at oxfordamerican.org. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. There's a new exhibit at the New Orleans Museum of Art about a city surrounded by water and famous throughout the world for its celebration of Mardi Gras. Wait for it. Venice. It's the only venue in the country presenting the exhibit. It includes paintings depicting the pageantry of Venetian life, 300-year-old carnival masks, and regal glass objects. NOMA curator Vanessa Schmid gives WWNO's Eileen Fleming a look at some of the treasures now on display.
So we're here at the exhibit, A Life of Seduction, Venice in the 1700s, and I'm here with the exhibit curator, Vanessa Schmidt. Vanessa.
Hi, Eileen. Thanks for having me back.
Tell me how this exhibit got going.
Conversation started between our director and a group in Italy that do exhibitions. What is the exhibition? It is A Life of Seduction, Venice in the 1700s. Yes, it's quite a title. And the exhibition, as a general matter, focuses on the pageantry, splendor, and ceremony of public and private life in Venice in the 18th century. So that's the 1700s. We go through that overarching idea through four themes. The first theme is called A Life Lived on Water. The second section of the exhibition deals with ceremony and the pageantry around power and government. After that, we are in aristocratic life in the palace and country setting. And the fourth theme is called City as Theater. And it deals with carnival and opera, all sorts of aspects.
This lush red just pulls you in like a piece of velvet.
Yeah, I always saw the show in burgundy red.
Let's take a quick stroll before your grand tour of Venice for us. Yeah. And some of the first rooms are paintings.
I'm surprised, Eileen, that the first thing you mentioned was painting. Look what we're standing in front of.
Okay.
Do you see what we're standing in front of? Isn't it stunning? What we're standing in front of is a gondola finial, the decorative ornament at the front of the boat. Beautiful, outstanding metal work that has all these beautiful motifs. There's an animal, there's a bird, there's a lion, and it's really exquisite. So that actually centers our first room. It's incredibly sculptural. And around it, yes, you mentioned some paintings. So this first room of the exhibition is called A City That Lives on Water. And one of the things that is so special that you were exactly looking at just now is a group of 12 paintings that actually take you through the canals that are just a delight in their details. And I should mention they are here from Turin, and one of the exciting things about this exhibition is the loans are gathered from 15 museums of Venice, and a good deal of things that actually have never left Italy, including this over here. This wonderful ducal hat. Doesn't it almost look like a soft serve ice cream in a way? It's kind of this beautiful sloping corn. It's called the corno, which means the corn.
And here we have some, are these costumes or are these actually the clothes of the day?
Oh, these are the clothes of the day. When we say costumes, of course, we use the term that we have costumes on display. That means to say historic clothing. And this is a first for NOMA. These are the first 18th century and historical costumes that NOMA's ever had on view. And so you see this woman's exquisite dress. This is white handmade quilting. Look at the details. And of course, to maintain such a perfect, crisp white, to iron it, to clean it, that of course is its own marker of status. It means you have a household to do so, right? And then look at this boy's red robe. Boys were not breeched, as they called it, did not put on pants or go into their attire of manhood until they could be, it was decided on the family, maybe they were 5, 6, 7, or 8. And so he's wearing his beautiful red robe.
The shoes.
Ah, of course. How can I not talk about the shoes? What you're looking at are these two clogs. How high are they? I mean, they're probably about 10 inches off the ground. And so they're these elevated clogs, and they have kind of bone inlay, so they almost look Arabic in a way, right, in terms of the motifs. These are made of wood, but you had elevated shoes throughout antiquity, also throughout history, also in ancient Rome. And so these became highly fashionable in Venice, but of course there was no walking happening in these. You put them on, and then you were lifted up, and you just stood at a party, but you had your fabulous shoes on. It kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? This is the height of female vanity, my dear. Here we are in the last room. We call it the city as theater. So it is about theater in the city. This is a really important moment in the history of theater. Opera, Vivaldi, of course, was in Venice. We have a puppet theater, which are 18th century puppets that we've reconstructed the stage around. But it's also the scene, the city as theater is also about the festivities and festivals around squares in Venice, and that take place throughout the course of the year. So we have Fat Thursday. It's actually Fat Thursday that is celebrated in Venice, and festivities around that, other fairs. And there's, oh, look over there, there's a wonderful little soccer game. That's 18th century soccer.
The puppets.
These are from the Casa Goldoni, which is a place in Venice. It's a place where Carlo Goldoni, who was a playwright, his portrait is over there, it was where he was born. And it's a small museum in Venice dedicated to theater, and this is a puppet theater. The puppets are staged to recreate Act 3 of Goldoni's Two Servants play that was written in 1645. And in fact, this puppet theater would have been in the palace of a family portrayed, the Sagredo family, in the Longhi portrait over there in the other room, which I think is their wonderful interconnections throughout the show. And so they are staging his exquisite play.
Vanessa, thank you very much.
Thank you, Eileen.
A Life of Seduction, Venice in the 1700s, runs at the New Orleans Museum of Art through May 21st. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack. Happy Mardi Gras!